Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. You're not hearing a familiar voice. Well, maybe it is a familiar voice from the olden days of the OG era of Inside the Hive. But I am your stand-in host today, Nick Bilton. Your usual hosts are off, I don't know, at a beach somewhere, enjoying life, raiding SVB's bank. I have no idea. We have a wonderful guest today, though. I'm very excited to bring you Zach Carter. Zach, say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Can you give us a little brief intro of who you are in under 280 characters, Zach?
Sure. I am the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes, which from the title you can probably tell is a biography of John Maynard Keynes. And prior to writing that book, I covered banking and politics for about a dozen years, most recently with the Huffington Post, but previously with a place called SNL Financial, which is now part of S&P Global.
Well, it's great to have you. We're going to talk today about the absolute and utter shit show that was the last couple of weeks surrounding Silicon Valley Bank and now what's happening with Credit Suisse and the economy and so on. And I'm really, really excited to talk to you because you wrote a fantastic piece for Vanity Fair. And let's just dive right in. This Silicon Valley Bank debacle kind of seemed to happen in a period of about 24 to 48 hours where everything was completely fine and everything was completely not. Walk us through how this particular bank collapse happened so quickly, or was it something that was already kind of the rot was already there and people in the industry knew or didn't know, or the government knew or didn't know? Like, explain how we kind of got to where we are in this particular moment.
Sure. You know, the nature of bank failures is that they tend to take people by surprise. People may be aware that there is some kind of problem or difficulty at a financial institution or two, but nobody thinks that it's a crisis until it's way out of hand. And all of a sudden, things get out of hand very quickly. In this case, there are sort of three separate failures that I think of with regard to Silicon Valley Bank. You have a broader deregulatory failure from Congress and the Fed. You have a monetary policy failure from the Fed. And then you have the specific peculiarities of the institution, Silicon Valley Bank, a management failure. In SVB's case, the bank had invested in a lot of government bonds and government-backed mortgage bonds, which are pretty safe assets so far as default is concerned. You know, if you're just waiting for these bonds to mature and collecting interest payments on them, there's not a whole lot of risk. If the government is going to default on its payments to you, you've got bigger problems than your bonds defaulting. However, they are subject to what is called interest rate risk. So if interest rates rise, then suddenly nobody wants to buy those bonds from you. So if you need to sell them in a hurry, you're not going to be able to get very much for them. So that's one half of Silicon Valley Bank's problem. The reason they needed to sell those bonds in a hurry was because they had an enormous amount of uninsured deposits. And uninsured deposits are one of the riskiest forms of funding for a bank. You know, the way banking works, you basically borrow money at a low interest rate and you lend it out at a higher interest rate. And the difference between those interest rates is the money that you make. So if people start withdrawing money from your bank, you need to have funds on hand to pay them. And in this case, Silicon Valley Bank specialized in a customer base of tech companies that were parking enormous amounts of money at the bank. I mean, the FDIC, the federal government, insures deposits of up to like $250,000. And there were companies like Roku that had nearly $500 million parked at this bank. So if you start having concerns about the stability of the bank, you're going to pull all of that funding at once. That is something that has been known about banking for hundreds of years. It's a very risky form of funding. And so a lot of these tech companies started having trouble over the last year or so as the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. So they were just drawing down their deposits steadily anyway in the normal course of business. People started having concerns about the stability of the bank, and then they started withdrawing them en masse. And the bank couldn't sell its assets at reasonable prices in order to get the funds it needed to meet those withdrawals. So money was going out the door. They couldn't sell assets to create new money to make those payments, and the bank failed. It's an extraordinarily poor it's just extraordinarily poor risk management by the bank, but in an environment, a deregulatory environment and an interest rate environment created by the federal government. So you have these sort of interdependent screw-ups where it's not just that the bank screwed up, although the bank did screw up. It's not just that the Fed screwed up, although the Fed did screw up. All of these things together create an environment where it's very easy for banks to do stupid things. And of course, we know that banks do stupid things all the time. Those of us who covered the financial crisis in 2008 know that a lot of dumb things happened there and that a lot of dumb things were going to happen again because that's how banking works.
One question I have is I would not consider myself the best investor on the planet. I did buy Bitcoin early and sold at the peak, but here's the example of how dumb I am when it comes to investing. I bought one Bitcoin, so otherwise I probably would be sitting on the beach with Emily and whoever else is there with them. They're not really on the beach. I'm just making that up. But I understand and understood over the past couple of years, because of all the money that was injected into the economy through the pandemic and so on, that interest rates were going to rise. And yet, why is it that these bankers didn't realize that? Or did they and think that it was going to be okay with the bonds? Like, well, how did that happen?
It's a very difficult question to answer, particularly when, you know, you can hedge against interest rate risks. There are products called interest rate swaps that you can buy as a banker. So if you're worried about the prospect of rates rising, you can protect yourself against that risk. And Silicon Valley Bank just didn't do that. You know, we're going to see a lot of different screw-ups over the next couple of weeks. The problems at Silicon Valley Bank are going to be related to problems at Credit Suisse. They're going to be related to problems at First Republic, but related in a sort of broad philosophical way. It's not like there are going to be direct creditor relation investor relationships between all of these institutions. But what you're going to see in each case is somebody doing something really stupid. and that is just something that happens in banking. There are a lot of banks. There have always been – banking is the process of taking on risk for profit. And when uncertain events – we live in an uncertain world, and when unexpected events arise that bankers did not prepare for, all kinds of bad things can happen. That's why – a phenomenon called bank regulation was invented. And it's also why, you know, prior to the 1980s, the Federal Reserve was very careful about raising interest rates very quickly. There's a very good piece in the Democracy, a Journal of Ideas by Chris Hughes on Arthur Burns, who was a much maligned Federal Reserve chairman from the 1970s. But one of the really interesting things about this this profile that came out a few months ago was just how obsessed this guy was with the prospect of financial crisis. He thought that raising interest rates would cause a significant repricing of really important assets across the global financial system and would bring a whole bunch of bank failures. And we've really stopped talking about that with regard to what the Fed does. You know, when we talk about Paul Volcker and the successful fight against inflation in the 1980s, we forget that a key tool in the fight against inflation for Volcker was mass bank failures and then mass bank bailouts. There's a series of banking crises across the 1980s, the most famous of which is the savings and loan crisis. But all of these are basically a product of raising interest rates very quickly. And I think the fact that we have started seeing the Fed predominantly as an institution that uses interest rates to fight inflation and not as an institution that's designed to preserve financial stability. And remember, the Fed is created in 1913 not to manage inflation but to serve as a lender of last resort to the banking system. You know, I think that's a significant change that we need to think a little bit more about. Interest rates in particular, I don't think are a totally great way to manage inflation. I mean, they function by causing layoffs. So I mean, you can say we're raising interest rates.
I want to get to the inflation question because I find it totally fascinating, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. But I just want to stick with SVB for 1 minute here. And one question I do have is, 2008, we had the banking crisis that took place there where, you know, I remember I was at the New York Times at the time, and I remember I think it was Andrew Ross Sorkin had said to me, you know, there were 5 days of the economy that could make it collapse if the decisions weren't correct, and there would be pitchforks in the street. And it really did feel like, you know, it was a real moment in time, Ed, that could have been a complete and utter disaster. And so after that, we got the Dodd-Frank bill, and that was essentially designed to avoid this from happening. But yet the CEO of SVB, who from the looks of it seems just like your typical evil banker, had thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe he's the nicest guy on the planet, but he does not seem to be very thoughtful. But from everything I've read, he was the one that was pushing against these bills. Why? Did he just think he was smarter than everyone else and that we didn't need them anymore? Like, if we'd have kept that, would we not be in the situation we're in today? Like, walk us through that.
I think the short answer is that, yes, if we had not deregulated banks like Silicon Valley Bank in 2018, it's very likely that we would not be in the situation we are today, or at the very least, the situation we are in today would be not nearly so precarious. And here's why. After Dodd-Frank, we implemented a series of tighter controls on the banking system that limited the banking system's ability to take on excessive amounts of risk. There were new capital requirements, which limited how much borrowed money banks could operate. They had to raise money through equity by selling stock rather than through debt. And they had to keep a certain amount of cash on hand, liquidity, to be able to meet withdrawals when things like, you know, mass withdrawals happen. Starting in 2015, Greg Becker, who's the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, went to Congress and said, look, I know my banking industry really well. I know my clients really well. My bank does not pose a systemic risk, and it's ridiculous for me to be subjected to the same systemic risk protocols that these multi-trillion dollar behemoths like Wells Fargo and JP Morgan are being subjected to. And for a lot of people in Congress, this seemed very intuitive. It was like, okay, these guys aren't these too big to fail monsters. You know, if they collapse, it'll be like a small problem, but it won't be like a problem for the broader economy. So let's let them take some more risk. And instead of subjecting banks with $50 billion in assets or more to these rules, they allowed banks with up to $250 billion in assets to be exempted from them. So $250 billion and above, you have these tighter standards. So Silicon Valley Bank, you know, grows its balance sheet enormously after this deregulation bill is passed, so because it's got $200 billion worth of wiggle room. The thing that's really astonishing about his statement from 2015 is that this debacle shows that he did not understand his customer base at all. He was operating with one of the riskiest forms of funding, uninsured deposits, at extraordinarily high levels. More than 95% of the deposits at Silicon Valley Bank were uninsured. I think it's not unheard of for banks to use uninsured deposits, but the typical ratio is something around 40%, 45% of deposits being uninsured. The vast majority of them, or the majority of them usually, at the vast majority of banks, are insured deposits. When you're operating with 95%, I mean, this is money in very large amounts that rich people are going to pull when there is trouble, and they have pulled money like this throughout history. So he not only didn't understand his clients, he also didn't understand that his clients were going to have trouble if interest rates rose. So on one side of the balance sheet, they make this big bet on interest rates that interest rates are going to stay low by purchasing all these securities without hedging the risk. On the other side, on the funding side, they just don't realize that all of these tech companies that do business with them are going to have trouble when interest rates go up, that they're not super profitable. And so they're going to be drawing down their balances as the economy, you know, as interest rates rise and their access to funding decreases. So you have this extraordinary statement from him in 2015 saying, I know what I'm doing and this bank is not a systemic risk. And then on Sunday night, the bank failing because he didn't know what he was doing, and all the three top federal regulators, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury Department saying, actually, your bank is a systemic risk and we're going to take emergency measures right now to protect your depositors. It's really extraordinarily bad bank management. But this sort of thing happens all the time.
But it's okay because It's okay because he's in Hawaii now at his house and he's relaxing by the beach. And so we should be thankful that he landed on his feet.
He made $45.7 million in the 5 years between when that deregulation law was passed and his bank failed. And he sold $3.6 million in stock just a couple weeks before the bank went under. It's like cartoon villain stuff.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
One of the things that has happened since is that we have started to see other banks now failing and the prospect of even more banks failing. And it feels like the thing that the both regulators and the bankers either don't understand or don't care about is just how intertwined the global economy is and the perception versus the reality of how the public sees the banking system and so on. And so I'm in Los Angeles, and in Brentwood there were local signature banks and so on that had lines of people waiting on the Sunday that SVB. It was bananas, It was like, unbelievable to watch. And how many banks do we expect are going to be affected by this? And how, and is it because there is this perception, that everyone panics and they think, oh, well, if it happened to that bank, it's going to happen to my bank and so on? Or is it because that there is a rot in the entire system similar to the one that SVB had?
Both. I think you're going to see Moody's and some other credit rating agencies have been taking action, downgrading a lot of these regional banks, these $50 billion to $250 billion sized banks, on the grounds that these banks are actually kind of a uniquely risky investment right now because of the 2018 law. It's interesting that we're not seeing the giant, banks that we think of as being too big to fail running into trouble right now because they're subjected to these tighter rules. And I think there's two sides to that. There's one, the actual technicalities of the rules being more relaxed against these banks makes them more vulnerable, but also just people understanding that they are more vulnerable makes people more prone to panic about them. So you have a psychological effect in addition to the sort of raw technical effect. And it doesn't help when you have ratings agencies saying, watch out, these banks may not be a safe bet anymore. So, there's a bank, First Republic, that's been in trouble this week. Doesn't appear to be any direct contagion from SVB or from Signature Bank or from Credit Suisse, but they do rely on a lot of uninsured deposits. I think about 67% of their deposits are uninsured. So people are starting to freak out, thinking, well, if other banks that have had high levels of uninsured deposits are in trouble, maybe my bank's in trouble, and they're pulling their money. And now First Republic is desperately trying to shore up funding. The short story is we don't know how bad this problem is, whether we are at the beginning of something or at the end. Nobody really understands the way lag times in monetary policy work. So what happened with SVB Bank was clearly a direct consequence of bad management, but an indirect consequence of the Fed raising rates over the past year. So is this the downstream effect of actions in March of last year from the Federal Reserve? Is it a downstream action of actions in September, December? We don't really know. And so the point of raising rates, of course, is to tighten financial conditions, essentially to make it harder to be a bank. And we don't know if things are getting really hard to be a bank right now because of something that just happened or something that happened a full year ago. But we do know that people are starting to really worry about it. And once the confidence in the system has been lost, it's very hard to reestablish it without a great deal of very powerful public action from the governments of the world. You know, as we saw in 2008, when the government let Lehman fail, things got really out of hand really quickly. I think regulators have learned that lesson, at least in the United States. But you can see everybody wants to try to create a situation where the market bears as much of the damage as possible and the public sector takes on the least amount of risk. And I think trying to thread that needle and finding the exact right balance often can put you in a situation where you're not communicating as a public official to the system that you really are going to stand behind it and make sure that you know, the whole thing doesn't burn down, which is, you know, fundamentally at this point, we're now talking about a confidence issue with the banking system. When you see different banks with different risk profiles and different sets of problems running into trouble at the same time, it is time to shore up confidence in the overall sector.
So one thing that that I'm curious about is during the pandemic, was $8 trillion that was injected into the system, which of course will change everything, right? It means that we are going to end up in the situation we ended up in, and I totally understand. Look, it's a panic moment. It's something we haven't experienced in 100 years. The government has to come up with solutions to ensure that the economy continues to operate and run, and the whole thing doesn't break down. But it seems almost inevitable that we are going to end up in a system where inflation runs out of hand, and we are going to have to solve that. And the way that the Fed has been solving it is by raising interest rates quite rapidly. And I mean, there was a point during the middle of the pandemic, early pandemic, where, you know, was it like a 30-year low, or the interest rates? I forget it was like around 2% or something, just astronomically insane. Money was so cheap. But it seems to me that they, you know, once you start raising interest rates, you end up in situations like this with the bond failures and so on. What could they have done differently, and what will they do going forward? Because they've already said they're going to stop raising rates. But then, does that stop inflation? So how do they manage this kind of seesaw problem that they have created, of course, themselves, but needs to at the same time be managed so that we don't end up in a situation where the $100 bill is worth, you know, a dollar or whatever would happen?
Well, to some extent, and a very moderate extent, I would dispute your premise here that some sort of inflationary debacle was inevitable once we were injecting $8 trillion of rescue money into the system. You know, the United States is a $22 trillion economy. $8 trillion over a couple of years is real money, but it doesn't necessarily have to lead to some sort of hyperinflationary debacle. And if you remember after 2008, I mean, we injected quite a bit of money into the system, and we had quite a few people prominently declaring that hyperinflation was just around the corner. The United States was going to be like, you know, Zimbabwe or the Weimar Republic. And we not only didn't see hyperinflation, we didn't see inflation at all. We saw persistent deflation, in fact, for much of the Great Recession. That's what the Great Recession was.
Why did we not see it, though, back then?
I think probably in large part because the demand that was destroyed during the financial crisis, you know, we just didn't spend enough money to get to get the general public back to a position of serious purchasing power, particularly with the banking system so decimated by a financial crisis. You know, lending was not occurring, so you weren't seeing business formation and the job creation that comes with that, the paychecks that you would expect the market economy to create. So you needed more support from the public sector to fight, you know, to basically create spending for folks where the spending didn't exist. In this crisis, you know, we did support the public sector and consumer pocketbooks directly in a much more aggressive fashion. And that's why we didn't have a 10-year recession outside of the pandemic, even though I think the damage to the economy was much, much greater from the pandemic than it was from the financial crisis of 2008. I mean, we just shut down a lot of the retail economy in 2020 for long periods of time. And there was, in fact, a deadly virus going around. So there were reasons that were going to – there were things that were going to hurt the economy independently of the public decision making. It wasn't just like some bankers went crazy here. The money did prevent, I think, mass joblessness. I think where you have a mismatch between supply and demand is in specific sectors, that are shut down as a result of the pandemic. So, for a long period of time, cars were really expensive. I think they still are. But this is because of weird stuff that people didn't see coming. Like there weren't enough microchips being made. A lot of microchip processing companies just stopped making the chips. Cars need a lot of chips, so you couldn't make cars. And when you couldn't make cars and you have this high level of demand in the economy, the price of cars goes way up. So it wasn't like we just had way too much purchasing power in the economy. We had too much purchasing power relative to these specific sectors, and those have been changing over the course of 2 years because people's spending habits change over the course of 2 years, particularly coming out of a pandemic. Like everybody moved at one point in time and they needed new appliances. Now nobody's moving, and so they're buying more appliances because they're staying in their homes. So different sorts of consumer habits have been changing. And mm-hmm. I think we'll know more about the specifics of inflation on a sector-by-sector basis when the whole thing is over and it's easier to look back on the situation. But clearly, there is some demand-supply mismatch, which is why you have inflation. The question then arises what to do about that inflation that exists. I think choosing between 7 or 8% inflation for a couple years and 7 or 8% unemployment, for me myself, I would gladly take the inflation over the unemployment. I mean, the damage to people's livelihoods from sustained job loss is really serious. And when we talk about managing inflation through higher interest rates, we're really talking about managing inflation through higher unemployment rates. So we're saying a few million people in the economy are going to pay an enormous price so that all of us can have somewhat cheaper eggs. And I think that's a measure of last resort if you can come up with other ways of dealing with inflation. The trick is we haven't managed inflation in any other way since the 1980s. So nobody who is involved in policymaking has been thinking creatively about how to keep inflation under control for quite some time. What we have done over the last year in response to the war in Ukraine has been to try to manage energy prices more directly. So in Germany, there's a program developed by an economist named Isabella Weber. They call it a price break, where they are just directly regulating the price of natural gas. And in the United States, they have been regulating the supply of oil. So you may have noticed over the summer, things started getting really out of hand with gas prices in particular by early summer. And then gas prices cooled off. And politically, in particular, inflation really stopped being such an albatross for the Democratic Party, in particular around the summer. That was because the Biden administration was selling a lot of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So they were introducing more oil to the market to lower the price of oil. So there's also a broader project with the price of Russian oil. They're trying to put a global price cap on oil. This is for foreign policy purposes. The idea is to keep the supply of oil coming but without allowing the Russian government to profit too much from it. So you see these sort of attempts in specific sectors with specific commodities to manage prices without resorting to interest rates. That's really hard, and it requires a lot of knowledge of these sectors. It requires knowledge of how they're structured. So like the Russian oil price cap, for instance, operates through the insurance system. It's a very complicated mechanism. You need people who really know what they're doing to implement this stuff. And unfortunately, we just don't have people who know how to do that right now. But I think it's time to start doing some research and getting some data.
So when you now look at what's happening, we're recording on a Tuesday, and I believe it was yesterday. It's all a blur. Credit Suisse, we had the Credit Suisse bank that was acquired. Is this a global, you're talking about Ukraine, you're talking about oil, you're talking about the I wrote extensively about the car issue during the pandemic and the chips, which were created in Asia, but were a result of copper mining in all around the globe that was halted. And we are in a clearly, and I know you've written about this quite extensively, interconnected world from an economic standpoint and so on. Is the Credit Suisse debacle was the first butterfly wings of that the results of the SVB, or was it something that was just brought to light as a result of it? How is this all interconnected, and how do we ensure that this doesn't lead to another global financial crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see with Credit Suisse, there's no direct relationship to what happened at SVB Bank. You know, it's not like Credit Suisse was like a big depositor at SVB. So when SVB failed, then people started freaking out and worrying about Credit Suisse. I mean, you see that kind of contagion in banking panics. And so far, at least, I think we have avoided that direct bank-to-bank freak out. The problem at Credit Suisse is sort of related philosophically. It's a similar type of problem. You know, they don't have, you know, these huge tech investments that SVB has, but Credit Suisse is a pretty lousy bank. I mean, to be blunt about it, it's always been bad. They just have scandal after scandal. I mean, going back to, like, you know, hiding Nazi money. Credit Suisse was one of the banks that the U.S. government really didn't go after banks after 2008 and 2009. It really issued prosecutions as much as it possibly could. But even Credit Suisse ended up pleading guilty to a felony to the U.S. Department of Justice. You know, they have problems with tax evasion, just all sorts of things, one thing after another. And so they're always sort of viewed as one of the weaker banks in the system. The sort of immediate issue for Credit Suisse was that the Saudi royal government said they were not going to make an investment into Credit Suisse, while also saying, but they have, you know, no concerns about the stability of the bank. You know, that's a difficult statement to take at face value. If you have no concerns about the stability of the bank, why are you not making an investment in it? It was a very clear signal from a major international investor that they believed Credit Suisse was in trouble and that its problems were bigger than what the Saudi royal family was willing to deal with. And after that, you see a lot of depositors pulling their money. So, yeah. You know, the problems in both of these cases, like SVB is a pretty lousy bank. It takes big risks and does stupid things. Credit Suisse is a lousy bank. It takes big risks and it does stupid things. And when you create a more difficult environment for banking, which is what happens when interest rates go up, you know, interest rates going up doesn't just immediately cause layoffs. It causes layoffs by making banking harder to do so that companies can't get access to funding. So when you make banking harder to do, the worst banks are the first banks to fail.
But wait a second. Aren't all banks pretty lousy banks and do stupid things? I mean, this is the history of the banking system in the United States specifically. It feels like, yes, there are banks that have lousy or stupider people running them and that make stupider decisions, but aren't they all? They all have some issue like these, right?
To some extent. I mean, there's a funny joke, like, when banks get in trouble, people say things, they made the classic mistake. They borrowed short and they lent long, you know, borrowing money that has to be paid back in a short period of time, making investments that pay off over a long period of time. That can be a way to get your bank in trouble. It's also a way to make a lot of money. I mean, most banking takes that sort of structure. Banking is inherently the process of taking on risk for profit. So, yes, to some extent, this is an issue. But there are elaborate mechanisms that people have developed over time to mitigate that risk. So you don't, for instance, have to have 95% of your deposits concentrated in uninsured deposits. You can have insured deposits. And you can still make money. You just won't make as much money because you make more money when you take on more risk. The deregulation law from 2018 is a really fascinating example because it was pitched as sort of a way for these small and medium-sized banks to make more loans. So really, it wasn't a favor for guys like Greg Becker who were going to pay themselves $45 million. It was a favor for, you know, some farmer in Virginia who was going to get a loan from one of these regional banks. I think that was a really misleading account of how this was going to work. What you're really doing is just allowing banks to take on more risk. It wasn't that they were going to be able to make more loans. It was that they were going to be able to make loans that scored more profit for the bank in the short term by generating higher, longer term risks. So, yes, all banks are risky. Are all banks as risky as SVB and Credit Suisse? No.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
One question I have, I want to kind of switch gears a little bit here, is that it's crypto. So when you look at the crypto markets, you know, there was, of course, it got to a height of Bitcoin got to the height of 69,000 at one point, and then, of course, plummeted due to a number of reasons. NFTs and all the, you know, it was all the hype and everything. But over the last couple of weeks, Bitcoin itself and the entire market has seen a little bit of a comeback. So you had, it was, I believe, down to around 20,000 right before SVB. And then now it's up to around 28,000. Is this the moment that you think that crypto will make a comeback? Or do you think crypto is not, you know, because people, the whole point of it, you know, back in the day was that it wasn't going to be run by stupid banks doing stupid things. Of course, it has a million of its own problems that we could spend hours and days talking about. But do you think that this gives crypto a little bit more of what it was hoping for and what it had before its own collapse earlier this year and last year?
I think crypto is sort of like the right-wing kind of Friedrich Hayek free market response to the 2008 financial crisis. The idea is that if banks and governments keep screwing things up, let's do an entire form of money that just doesn't require government oversight and government management. And you understand why this would be, appealing to certain people. It's sort of an attempt to mimic the gold standard, which was the monetary system that existed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, where governments did have some management control over the monetary system, but the value of currency was tied to a certain amount of gold, and that could not change. And this was viewed as sort of a way to prevent inflation, the same way that there can only be so many bitcoins in the system, right? So you're never going to print so many bitcoins that your investment will be devalued due to inflation. I think it's very difficult to say that the crypto industry functioned as a currency over the past decade. I think that dream died several years ago, and crypto has instead been functioning as a kind of speculative investment. And as a purely speculative investment with no attachment to industry, production, even business services, it becomes uniquely susceptible to swings in market confidence. And to some extent, ironically, I think kind of a creature of the Federal Reserve. As soon as the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, you saw the price of Bitcoin and all of these crypto instruments collapse.
Why is that? I'm curious. I don't understand why that happens. If the Fed starts raising interest rates, wouldn't you imagine that these crypto assets would go the opposite direction?
I think it depends on who you talk to on these things. I mean, my view in this particular case is that because there is no underlying asset to the crypto mechanism, you know, it's just a token that people are betting on. There's nothing to liquidate if the economy gets into trouble. You know, if you own a stock or a bond, there is at least some attachment to a real economic process and a real economic asset that eventually can be liquidated, at a loss. But you have some form of protection. with crypto, it's just a purely speculative instrument. And there's no sort of public entity to maintain confidence when confidence is lost. So when you see the sort of animal spirits taking over and people starting to feel, oh, my goodness, you know, Tether's not worth something or Dogecoin is not worth anything, there's no lender of last resort. There's no, you know, mechanism involved to stop prices from falling. And so there's no system in place to stop essentially a run on the currency. Whereas in the banking system, you have the Federal Reserve, you have the FDIC, you have a public backstop to say, whoa, this stops here. Even SVB Bank, you know, it's taken over by the FDIC. The bank fails. Its depositors are all being made whole by the federal government.
And there is no crypto. There's no crypto version of that.
Right. Yeah. And by design, I mean, the whole point of crypto is supposed to say we don't want the government in here meddling in the value of this currency. But what that means is that it's uniquely susceptible to crises of confidence. Now, when I say it depends on who you talk to, each one of these crypto devices has its own, you know, specific mechanism, device, whatever that it says is mm-hmm. designed to make it impervious to risk due to its, you know, in the market. But ultimately, they all rely on market mechanisms. And eventually, you get to a point where people lose confidence in the market and crypto is helpless. Will prices bounce back? I mean, it's a speculative investment. They very well may. I mean, and I think in crypto, it's really hard to get a good read on what's going on because the industry is so opaque. So we don't know what the volume of trading looks like right now, for instance. And we have no real way of predicting where things are going to go because there's no like balance sheet to look at. There's no earnings report. There's no – with SVB, we know the situation of the bank. We know why it's bad. And there's a story we can tell to investors about why they should or shouldn't put their money there. With Bitcoin, it's like, well – you know, it's kind of like the oldest cryptocurrency, I guess. You can't create the same sort of, narrative to build confidence.
I have a last few questions for you. How does the collapse of SVB affect the venture capital tech industry as a whole? Does it slow down investing? Does it have no impact? You know, there's an irony to what happened where you have all these VCs, David Sachs and Peter Thiel and people who have lamented the U.S. government and its involvement in everything and that there should be no regulation and this, that, and the other. And then as soon as their money was potentially being affected, they were like, I need it back. The FDIC has to step in and raise how much they're going to give me and so on. But at the same time, there is also a slightly terrifying moment that happens for some of these tech startups where they can't cover payroll and potentially and, these VC firms that, you know, were using SVB to get cash quickly to be able to give to new clients and so on and so forth that's now been affected and changed. Does this have an impact, you think, on Silicon Valley?
Oh, I think it certainly will. I think it's hard to predict exactly, you know, what the scope of the change will be. But clearly, one of the problems at SVB is just that the tech sector was already having a lot of trouble. And part of that is just the nature of tech. I mean, these are investments in new companies that are supposed to be new ideas, new ways of making money, and they're not going to be profitable at first. And you don't know how long it will take until they get profitable. And a lot of them are never going to be profitable. I mean, a lot of businesses don't pan out, right? So you're inherently supporting
in the tech space, it's about 98% of them that don't pan out.
And that's why, you know, tech is the first industry to really take it on the chin when interest rates go up. It's not an established business with decades of track records and multiple lines of, revenue that it can rely on when costs go up and funding becomes more difficult to obtain. The tech sector is already under a lot of pressure. But I think this, the arrangement with Silicon Valley Bank is very peculiar, right? I mean, most institutions with $500 million in cash to spare don't just stick it in a non-interest-bearing checking account. That's a stupid use of money, right?
Yeah.
Even if you have payroll to meet, you know, you don't have $500 million in payroll to meet every week. So you would think they would be investing this money in other places and having it go to work. So there's some sort of odd arrangement here where these startups are getting funding through the VCs and then the VCs are for some reason insisting that these companies park their money at this one bank with extraordinarily poor risk controls. I don't think like the Silicon Valley Bank arrangement is going to like persist going forward. But, you know, the unfortunate thing about raising rates and about economic slowdowns, which is, you know, the Fed is trying to impose an economic slowdown in order to fight inflation, is that it's just harder to run a business, and it's harder to get a good idea off the ground. It's also harder to get a bad idea off the ground. And there are a lot of bad ideas in tech. I think basically most of the crypto industry, if not the whole thing, is a bad idea, and it doesn't cause me great distress philosophically to see that sector sort of going away. Although, it's really terrible to watch people lose their savings in these kinds of speculative routes.
Some people, it's some people we can not feel bad for the trillionaires out there. We know
right.
Who they are.
Well, and that's that's part of the problem with SVB and the bank rescues. I think it's easier to feel for a company like Roku that had $500 million parked at SVB. You know, you don't want to see this company just go out of business.
Correct. Yeah.
Because that sucks. Than like these venture capitalists who had $10 million parked there for their personal account. Like, why did you do that? You know, you're smart enough and rich enough to know better here. But the nature of rescue operations and financial crises is that, you know, you need to to
you need
stop
to rescue
the
everyone.
Right.
You don't save just a few people from the sinking ship. You have to save them all, even if you don't necessarily want to. Yeah,
and I think the role there for people who are concerned about justice and fairness, which we should all be concerned about justice and fairness. I think there's a role there for the criminal justice system, for prosecutions, for investigations, for individuals who did things that were inappropriate and against the law. I mean, you should pursue the government should pursue cases against those people.
Yeah.
But you don't need to, wipe out millions of dollars or billions of dollars just to make sure that a handful of rich people aren't getting too much at the front end of this arrangement.
I have two last questions for you. One is a little pie in the sky one, but we'll start with the penultimate question, which is, we learned something from the Great Depression. We learned something from the 1980s financial crisis, from the 2000 and there are usually often, not usually, there are always changes that happen in the system as a result of this. What will we have learned from this? And do you foresee changes, Dodd-Frank coming back or something new that will avoid something like this happening again? Or was it because we have seemingly stop this from being a massive crisis that it just will be like a little road bump in the economy as far as the government is concerned and onwards that we go?
At least so far in this crisis, a lot of the things that were put in place after 2008 seem to be holding up pretty well. The too big to fail side of the banking system has not failed. So you're not seeing the JP Morgans and the Wells Fargos collapsing yet. if the crisis continues to accelerate and expand, you could see those banks getting in trouble eventually. But even the fact that they're not the first up against the wall, I think suggests that some of the regulatory measures taken after 2008 were really productive and have had the desired effect. You can never fully protect the banking system against absolutely every risk possible, but so far, a lot of those risk controls have proved effective. Where they haven't worked is with these regional banks, which pose different kinds of risks, and we just took the risk management controls off of those for no real reason in 2018. Within 5 years of deregulating the regional banks, we have a regional banking crisis. So I think there's a pretty clear regulatory response that I think I'm optimistic enough to believe Congress will learn that lesson and take the steps to re-regulate the section of the financial system that was deregulated. The broader point, though, is on interest rates and how to manage inflation, because there are real reasons why the Fed has been raising rates. Inflation is a problem, and people are worried that inflation could get worse. I said earlier, the choice between 8% unemployment and 8% inflation isn't a hard one for me. I'd way rather see 8% inflation. But the choice between constantly accelerating inflation and 8% unemployment is harder to make. And there are people of good faith at the Fed who are worried about that outcome. And I think the harder lesson to learn here for for the financial system is that the way we've been managing inflation for the last 40 years is not very effective. I mean, even if you like the idea of using interest rates to manage inflation, here we are in a banking crisis where now we have to basically turn that process off if we want to avoid widespread bank failures. The Fed's going to stop raising rates at the rate that it has been unless it's totally lost its mind because
I think they already announced that they were going to stop for a while.
So clearly, the mechanism itself is just not particularly efficient, even if you're in love with the mechanism itself. So I think, the sort of utopian big, grand lesson to learn would be that, we need a broader set of tools. We need to be able to look at inflation in a more, under a microscope and pick sectors and deal with data and commodities in ways that we just haven't tried to do for a long time. The idea that just by dialing up interest rates a little or dialing them back, we can manage the entire economy. It's a beautiful dream. It would be really nice if it were just that easy.
Yeah.
But I think, unfortunately, the world is more complicated and you need expert knowledge of this stuff. And the Fed has a lot of economists. I mean, they hire a lot of economists, and I think they just need to be studying different things now.
All right, last question for you. It's a little far out there, but I'm going to throw it out there. So ChatGTP, GPT-4, AI, I've been covering technology for 20 years, and I've never, ever seen anything that has scared the shit out of me more than it. I think that it is going to – the job loss is going to be massive, and it is going to happen – as fast as lightning when it starts. It hasn't started yet. I mean, it has a little bit. We started to see a couple of instances of CNET reporters being let go, and they're using some algorithm to write little stories instead of them, and you're starting to see instances of people using ChatGPT instead of accountants and lawyers and so on and so forth. But the speed with which it is coming is, I think, going to be unlike anything in human history, quite frankly. And that's not just me being hyperbolic. And the job loss and the impact on the economy and the banking system. And when you look at the papers talking about some of the jobs that will be the first to go, they are the banking system. Do you worry about what will happen as a result of both from an economic standpoint, from a banking standpoint, from all of these different things as a result of AI, or are you just not there yet?
Yes and no, which I know is a weasel answer. But automation is not new to the banking system, and AI is just like warp speed automation, right? I mean, even the ATM is a form of automation, and it did, in fact, reduce the number of bank teller jobs. Did that become a crisis for the banking system or the broader economy? I don't think so. Look at a company like Vanguard, for instance. The whole appeal of a company like Vanguard is that they don't do a whole lot of fancy risk projections and analysis. They invest in index funds, and they keep their overhead as low as possible. And that became enormously popular with people because they said, yeah, what's the point of trying to beat the market? Why don't we just invest in the whole market? The Vanguard situation is interesting because they have cut costs so much that Vanguard now has some of the worst customer service in the financial industry, and they're losing clients over it. So I think, if you can get AI to give you good customer service, then yeah, there's a potential to lose a lot of jobs here. Do you want to be having a large part of the banking system paying out high salaries to people to do clerical tasks? I mean, that doesn't seem like it's inherently an important aspect of the economy and the financial system. It would be more productive without some of that, and we could spend the wealth on more vacations for people and higher wages for other workers. It all depends on whether the automation is actually any good, when I have played around with it, trying to do financial journalism leads and stuff, I'm not too worried about being AI'd out of a job just yet on that stuff. It may get good enough that, that I'm, my livelihood is in jeopardy. But for the moment, I'm not that worried about it. I think automation tends to, it does do what people say. It does destroy jobs, but it also creates other jobs. And more productive economies are wealthier economies. So, provided you have a public sector that's willing to tax away wealth where it accumulates when this stuff happens and redistribute it to ordinary folks, it's not inherently a debacle for the entire economy. But the period of adjustment can be very sharp, and you have, and it's a big if. Is the public sector willing to do the distribution function that we currently have, the bank teller system doing? That's an open question. It's a political question, and our politics aren't great right now. So I think that, there are reasons to worry, but there are also reasons not to panic.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has really been a truly fascinating conversation. Tell everyone where they can find your work and you and so on.
Sure. I'm on Substack, just ZacharyDCarter.substack.com. And then I write for places like Vanity Fair and all kinds of magazines.
Well, thank you so much, Zach. It's been so fascinating to talk to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, "Oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?"
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.